This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week, we're celebrating pop culture that you can't accuse of being subtle. Our series is called Big, Bombastic, Brassy, and Trashy. But for today's show, we'd better throw in the words fast and cheap because it's about B-movies. We start with the king of the Bs, producer and director Roger Corman. He's churned them out in nearly every genre: science fiction, horror, monster and gangster films, and westerns. He also directed Youth in Revolt movies like The Wild Angels, starring Peter Fonda, who we'll hear from in a couple of minutes, as the leader of the Hells Angels. The movie helped establish Fonda's career and helped inspire the film Easy Rider. When I spoke with Corman in 1990, he told me the story behind The Wild Angels.
There was a lot of talk about the Hells Angels at that time, and I remember in, it was either Time or Newsweek magazine, there was an article on them, and at the top of the page was a picture of a Hells Angels funeral. It took place in some woods, and they were carrying the coffin, but the members were riding their bikes. And the visual power of that photograph really impressed me. And I was having lunch with Jim Nicholson and Sam Arkoff, who ran American International, and we were talking about various ideas for a film that we might do together, and it kind of came up between all of us that we all thought the Hells Angels would be a good subject. So we agreed that we would do a film about the Hells Angels. I wanted the Hells Angels not to be the nemesis, the heavies. I wanted them to be the leads in the picture. So I developed with Chuck Griffith my own script, which eventually became The Wild Angels. And for a little while there, I and Chuck were hanging out with the angels, going to their parties and so forth. And the picture became a loose compendium of stories they told us about things that they had done.
So tell me what you were like when you were hanging out at Hell's Angels parties.
I was not quite one of the angels. I made a point of bringing the beer and possibly helping to bring some marijuana and one thing and others. And Chuck and I were reasonably well accepted, but we were never quite with them. I remember at one time I was had spent a lot of the evening sitting drinking beer and talking with the old lady that is the girlfriend of the president of the chapter of the Hells Angels. And Chuck came over to me and he said, "You're spending too much time talking to that girl. The leader of the angels has been watching you. He doesn't like it in any way whatsoever." And I realized for a little while I had forgotten what kind of party I was at and where I was. So I said goodbye to her and went over and talked to some guys about some bikes.
Now, you cast some actual Hells Angels as extras in the movie, right?
Yes. We had members of the Venice and San Bernardino chapters of the Hells Angels.
Did they give you any trouble?
No, they didn't really give me trouble. I was very careful as to how I was going to handle them. I thought about it, and I thought, I'm not going to be able to order them around, and that's not my style as a director anyway. On the other hand, I can't appear to be too weak because they'll start to push me around. So I determined that the thing to do was try to be as objective and unemotional as I could and simply to say, "All right, fellas, the bikes start here. You're going to ride up to here, you're going to turn around that corner, and you're going to pull up in front of that bar over there, and you pull out, and you run into the bar." And I would try to say it that way so it was clear what I wanted, but that I wasn't trying to force them to do anything. And I think they understood and appreciated that, and by and large, we got along pretty well.
Did you pay them well?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I don't remember the exact amounts of money, but it was interesting. We worked out the payment. They got a certain amount of money per day for each angel, and then they got a little bit less than their personal fee to bring their bikes, and then they got a little bit less than the bikes for bringing their women. So this was their scale of values.
Peter Fonda starred in Wild Angels as like the head of the biker gang. He later starred with Dennis Hopper in Easy Rider. But in Wild Angels, there's something very innocent and vulnerable looking about him in spite of the way that he's cast. Did you realize that at the time?
I knew that, and it was a little bit of a problem because I wanted Peter in the film. He was a good actor. He had the right persona, but he's a very tall, thin person, and he wasn't really as tough or as tough looking as the angels. For that reason, I had him wear a couple of layers of clothing throughout the film in order to build up a little bulk. So I was aware of that, but I did what I could.
Director and producer Roger Corman. We'll get back to Corman a little later. First, let's hear from the star of his biker film, Wild Angels, Peter Fonda. That film helped inspire Fonda to make Easy Rider, which brought to the screen a new kind of American hero, the hippie drifter. I spoke with Peter Fonda in 1998.
I think it's time to hear a scene from Wild Angels, your first biker film. And now, in this scene, you're at the funeral of a biker played by Bruce Dern, and his coffin is covered by a Nazi flag. There's a minister delivering a eulogy, which you think is really phony, so you interrupt the eulogy to say this.
Yeah, we don't want nobody telling us what to do. We don't want nobody pushing us around.
I apologize. But tell me, just what is it that you want to do?
Well, we want to be free. We want to be free to do what we want to do. We want to be free to ride. And we want to be free to ride our machines without being hassled by the man. And we want to get loaded. And we want to have a good time. And that's what we're going to do.
Well, when, baby? Let's go.
We're going to have a good time. We're going to have a party.
And as you can hear, they are totally tearing apart the church.
I warned you about that one already.
Peter Fonda, your thoughts listening back to this scene?
Far out.
That's groovy would be the other alternative.
No, not groovy, just far out. And, you know, what the heck. You would have to pick that scene now, wouldn't you? I didn't write it.
Who did?
I can't remember.
How did those lines sound to you at the time? You want to be free to not be hassled by the man.
I thought I had a better way of saying it, but I was reminded that I was playing the leader of a motorcycle gang and didn't necessarily have that larger vocabulary.
Well, this is the leader of a Hell's Angels gang. A kind of real switch from previous roles that you had in movies like Tammy and the Doctor and Lilith. What did you think of yourself as being the biker?
Well, I mean, I liked the job I did in Lilith. I thought I fit the bill well. And in my later years now, I'm enjoying hearing that from people. But I didn't want to be cast as the sensitive roles all the time, and that's what my agents had in mind for me. They thought they wanted me to become the next Dean Jones for Disney. I had other thoughts afoot here. I was a bit too radical for that. And so I started to strike out in a different way.
Now, what do you think Corman cast you in the biker role?
I think he saw me as this very rebellious person who didn't give a rat's ass and went out there and just did what was most, I guess, obnoxious, or at least what shook the cage. Whatever would shake the cage the most into any kind of really set in legislative morality. I really believe that abstract morality has no place in our political or our everyday lives. And I mean, arbitrary morality and abstract authority certainly doesn't. So he saw me as somebody who was always watching for something to step on that looked like abstract authority or arbitrary morality.
So listen, when you were cast in Wild Angels, were you already riding a motorcycle?
Yeah, I'd been riding around a lot with various other glitterati, McQueen and Brando, myself, Ted Marklin, people that...
Oh, boy, it would have been fun to see you and Brando, who had also played a biker, riding around together.
Oh, yeah, actually, he asked me to come by his house one afternoon, and he said... Come by my house. I left my motorcycle down at Wally Cox's. I went, would you take me down there? I said, sure, Bud. We called him Bud because that was what he was known as a young man in Omaha. A junior in the Midwestern term is always known as Bud. Instead of Marlin Jr. or Junior, he was called Bud. And I said, yeah, Bud, I'll come by. He said, but bring your Bonneville. I had a Triumph Bonneville. And... You know, I thought maybe a car would suffice, but, oh, sure, you can ride in the back of my my motorcycle as we're riding down Ventura Boulevard trying to beat the rain. Marla leaned forward and whispered in my ear, "Did you hate your father?" I thought to myself, that's the strangest question to have come from this dude who's holding on his arms around me. I'm wondering, why does he have his arms around me? What am I in for with Marlon here?
What'd you say?
I just said no. Right. In the long run, Marlon, no. And I talk about it in that way in the book. Uh-huh. An example that, in fact, I knew that I loved my father. I was confused and wondered whether he loved me.
My guest is Peter Fonda. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Peter Fonda. When we left off, we were talking about the biker film The Wild Angels.
Now, there is a poster of you from this movie that you say sold, what, 16 million copies in America or something like that?
Easily, yeah.
How seriously did you take yourself at the time as a biker icon?
I didn't even put those two things together. I was brought into Corman's office. He was over at 20th Century Fox. Had a deal making films over there. And he said he wanted to make... And my hair was rather long, and I was considered a weird hippie. And he said he wanted to make a motorcycle movie, a movie about the Hells Angels that wasn't making a statement, which I found to be rather far out, because I think anytime you make a movie about the Hells Angels, you're covering statement all over the place. So I thought, well, let's see if he can do it. I said, I'm in. And eventually I was called. And actually, the first time I was called to play Bruce Dern's part.
The loser.
The loser, yeah. And I said, well, I can do this one easily. Anyway, it turned out that the fellow who's cast to play the part that I ended up playing didn't know how to ride a motorcycle, so I got the gig. But at the same price, I got to play for being the loser, who's a stiff for about a third of the film.
Right. It's funny, when you were young and going to boarding school and private school, you write that you had the image of being a sissy, and for a while you were even called Fairy Fonda. That was in part because you had to play the role of a fair maiden in the Pirates of Penzance at an old boys' school.
Also, the fact that I weighed probably 82 pounds.
Yeah, you were real, like, skinny marink at the time. Not that you ever put on a lot of weight in later life, but... anyways, it's a kind of far cry from that image, you know, from the sissy image that you had to, you know, the biker.
Worked.
Did you like that change? Did you find it amusing, or did you take it really seriously?
Well, that particular part of the change I found very amusing. And even writing the script with Dennis, it was a lot of fun and an amusement to it. I was definitely bent to do something different in my life, and I went for it. Next film, what are you going to do next? Let me find out if I should chain myself to this chair and handcuff myself so I don't come crawling through the mic.
I have a question about Roger Corman's The Trip, but you'll be spared from any clips.
Oz, roll the clips, I can handle it.
Okay, this is an LSD movie with lots of like swirling psychedelic colors intercut in the trip scenes. Now, I imagine you were already tripping a lot yourself when you shot this movie?
No, you couldn't really do that. I think I'd end up looking at the camera and just starting to crack up, thinking these guys are really serious, aren't they?
No, I don't mean while making the movie, but I mean, I don't mean you were high during the shooting of the movie necessarily, but you already knew a lot about acid trips by the time you made the movie, right?
Not a lot, I think. I only took my reputation for consumption far exceeds the actual amount of controlled substances that I ever attempted or tried. I knew what it was. I had an altered state several times before Roger and I talked about making a movie about that thing, and I tried to get Roger to go for it, too, so he'd know what an altered state was, because I was very specific, and I said, it's not, you know, about flashing lights and swirling things overlaid on images on film. That's what you see in the discotheques, because they don't know how to recreate it. And Jack Nicholson wrote the script, and Jack's script was absolutely brilliant. He did it all with stock footage, some footage that we would shoot, in a cutting matter. In other words, he made the rhythm of the cuts and what the visual image was against your eyes into an altered state. It was a brilliant thing. And Roger copped to the flashing lights and swirling things, overlaid images of the rest of us, which rather disappointed me. But the good part about it all was first that I got to work with Dennis Hopper, who was in the film in a supporting role, by telling Roger, who was not going to shoot some of the images that were really necessary to make something out of it. And Dennis and I went off with the camera and film to the desert and shot stuff of me running through sand dunes and things like that. They intercut very well, but you sure could see the difference in the footage we shot compared to the footage that Roger shot.
Now, how did you and Dennis Hopper decide to do Easy Rider, your own version of a biker film?
Well, as I said, I had been given this as my daily lesson. What it was, I was in Toronto, Canada, in September of 1967, attending a big convention of theater owners and exhibitors and distributors. And at the second day of lunch with 1,200 people, I was up at a big table of glitterati. Now, I had been through all this, the normal stuff of selling a film, talking to the press, so I had a very nice custom-made double-breasted suit and a really cool shirt and tie and no shoes or socks. So everybody would come in to visit me, to interview me, just couldn't take their eyes off the fact that I had bare feet, and they just stared at the bare feet, which was, of course, the desired effect. And actually, the day before, when I was given my lesson by Jack Valenti, he looked right at me as I was sitting down on the floor with the rest of the plebes and said, "We have to stop making movies about motorcycles, sex, and drugs, and start making more movies like Dr. Doolittle, which cost $27 million. And I went back to my room. Okay, no more sex, motorcycles, sex, and drugs movie. But I had come up with this story the night before I said that line of Easy Rider. Called Dennis on the phone. It was 4:30 Toronto time. On the 27th of September, 1967. And 1:30 in L.A. time, and I called Dennis, told him the story that I'd made up, and he said, "That's far out. What are you going to do?" I said, "Well, I thought you'd direct it, I'll produce it, we'd both write it and act in it, we could save some money, and I believe we'd make a movie that would be commercially successful." And that's how it started.
What did you want your motorcycle to look like for the movie?
Just what it looked like, all that steel and all that engine between my legs and that red, white, and blue and star-spangled gas tank. I thought it was like a huge phallic symbol that I'd be riding across the country.
And that's the effect you wanted.
Well, exactly. And Dennis wanted me in white leathers, and I said, no, this is an evil Knievel. We stay in black leathers. We don't want to count out the S&M crowd from this movie. We want to get as many people in here as possible, and black leather plays a lot better, believe me, Dennis. And so, anyway, I put spurs on even. Very few people realize that I was wearing spurs during that movie. I was trying to tell you we were making a Western that happened to have sex and drugs and motorcycles in it.
You say in your book that as soon as you had your motorcycle and your leathers, you started riding the L.A. freeway at night to practice, I guess. But you were stopped every night by the police. What were those encounters like?
Well, I was stopped because I was wearing the flag on the back. I had the costume on, and I had the flag in the back of my jacket. And they thought I was degrading the flag. So they would arrest me, and, of course, I made sure that I didn't have any money with me. I had my driver's license and Platinum American Express card, but no money. And they would bust me for vagrancy and take me down. Eventually, they'd have to let me go and bring me back to my motorcycle, and off I'd go and riding around. After the success of the film in 1969, by 1970, every cop car had a flag on its fender, every cop had a flag on his sleeve, and suddenly it was hip to wear flags wherever you wanted them all the time. It was more of an homage than it was something against the country. I got the idea, by the way, from John Wayne in Flying Tigers. Only I decided that a national Chinese flag wouldn't really work too well in Easy Rider.
Now, what did your father, Henry Fonda, think of Easy Rider and your image as, the countercultural movie star who rode a motorcycle and went on, trips of both kinds, the acid and road kind? In movie terms, it made a fortune. I mean,
but you didn't know that yet.
So, right,
and I knew we would make some money, and therefore mm-hmm. Dennis and I would have a track record, and we could make another motion picture. It was later into it that I realized how far out it would go. And my dad, by this time, by the way, I realized we were going to go to a much broader audience than I figured mm-hmm. originally. My dad said, this is pretty thin here. I don't think people are going to understand what's happening. I mean, we don't know where you're going. I said, "Well, Dennis says, I'm going down to Mardi Gras. I'm going to get me a Mardi Gras queen in the first campfire." Dad said, "Well, son, that's a little bit thin. I don't think that'll hang in there. I don't think we'll stay with you." And he was entitled to his opinion. But what he hadn't factored in fact, I wish I was smart enough to say that I factored in, was as the flower children and hippies came into being, we had our own language, we had our own art, we had our own poetry, music, our whole morality, our customs. What we didn't have was our own movie. And when Easy Rider popped on, that became our own movie, and that transcended everything else and became the icon that it was.
Peter Fonda recorded in 1998. This summer, he starred in the PBS movie A Thief of Time, based on a Tony Hillerman novel. More on B-movies in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's B-movie day in our series Big, Bombastic, Brassy, and Trashy. Let's get back to the king of the bees, Roger Corman. He directed many movies in the 50s and 60s, including Bucket of Blood, Little Shop of Horrors, The Pit and the Pendulum, and The Wasp Woman. In the 70s, his company New World Pictures turned out genre films and movies that tried to cash in on the success of mainstream blockbusters. Corman's Piranha followed Jaws. After Star Wars, Corman made Battle Beyond the Stars. He's still producing and distributing movies through his company Concord New Horizons. Many now famous people got their start working on Corman's low-budget films, people like Martin Scorsese, John Sayles, Francis Ford Coppola, and Robert De Niro. Jack Nicholson got his start playing a masochistic dental patient in Little Shop of Horrors. Let's start with a scene.
You know, most people don't like to go to the dentist, but I rather enjoy it myself, don't you? I mean, there's a real feeling of growth, of progress when that old drill goes in. I mean, I'd almost rather go to the dentist than anywhere, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Now, no Novocaine. It dulls the senses.
This is gonna hurt you more than it is me.
Oh, goody, goody, here it comes.
A lot of incredible actors and directors got started working with you. I'd like to hear the stories behind how you came across some of them. Why don't we start with Jack Nicholson, who I think a lot of people remember his role in Little Shop of Horrors as the masochistic dental patient.
Right.
How did he come across your attention?
Well, I met Jack in an acting class given by Jeff Corey, and I'd been directing maybe 4, 5, 6 pictures when I felt I really had to learn more about acting and actors. So I enrolled in the acting class and met Jack there. From the beginning, I was impressed with his ability. He was and is a very dedicated actor who delves deeply into a character, does a great deal of research, and then is able to bring a great quality of personal humor and insight to the character, and is willing to take chances to go into areas where other actors might pull back. They might prefer to play it safe.
You are, I think, the undisputed king of the cheap, fast movie. Let's talk about some of the ways you developed to make movies that were fast and cheap. I think one of the things you've done a lot is shoot two movies back to back.
Yes. I first started doing that when we would go on location. The cost of taking a movie crew, even a small movie crew such as I would normally work with, the cost of taking that crew on location is fairly high. So if I would go to a location and do two pictures in the location, I could amortize the cost over two pictures. The same thing when shooting in Hollywood, if you're going to build fairly elaborate sets, I would try to find, whenever I could, a second picture that could take advantage of those sets. I would then rearrange the flats a little bit, repaint them so that they would look a little bit different for the second picture, but essentially I could use the elements twice.
Name two movies that were shot back-to-back like this.
All right. I did actually three pictures once in Puerto Rico when I took a company there. We did Battle of Blood Island, a World War II picture, and then I directed The Last Woman on Earth, which was written by Bob Towne and actually starred Bob under the name Edward Wayne as an actor because he hadn't finished the script, and I didn't have the money to take him to Puerto Rico to finish the script and take an actor also. And I said, Bob, you're playing the second lead in the film. And then when we were there and things were going well, I called Chuck Griffith and gave him the idea for a comedy horror science fiction film to be called Creature from the Haunted Sea, and we threw in the third picture as well.
So, okay, now casting Robert Towne, the screenwriter, as one of the stars of the movie, I guess that's another example of saving money.
Yes, but I knew that Bob was and is a good actor. He'd been in the same acting class I'd been in with Jack Nicholson and a number of others, and I knew he was a talented actor.
You've worked in many different genres over the years, and one of the genres that you describe yourself as having created is the black humor horror film, and included in that category would be Little Shop of Horrors and Bucket of Blood. Why did you decide to combine horror and comedy, and did you wonder if the horror audience would be interested in seeing a movie that mocked itself in some ways?
I got the idea of combining horror with humor at a sneak preview of one of my films when a sequence, which was designed as a horror sequence, worked very well, and the audience screamed, really screamed, very loudly. And immediately thereafter, they laughed. And then they got back into the film. And I thought, what they've done is they've reacted the way I wanted, they've screamed at the right moment, and then they realized that they'd been led into it, and they laughed in an almost appreciative way at what I'd done and what their reaction to it was. And I thought there's really a connection there between horror and humor. And then I read a book called Beyond Laughter by a psychiatrist, I think his name was Dr. Grotjohn, in Beverly Hills, in which he talked about the relationship between horror and humor. And I went to see him, as a matter of fact, paid him $100 for 1 hour to talk with him. And he told me some of his theories. And I decided to do a film that would be a comedy horror film, and that was Bucket of Blood, which I shot in 5 days, starring Dick Miller, written by Chuck Griffith. And the film was rather successful and very funny. It did just what I wanted it to do. It got the screams at the right points, and it got a lot of laughter in between. I was very pleased with it, so I tried another one, which was Little Shop of Horrors, which was more slanted towards the humor and less towards the horror. The horror was there, but it was really almost comic horror. And that picture had a rather strange history. It was very wild, rather original, and I shot it in only 2 days and a night, and I expected that I should either have a great success with something like this or a complete failure. It was so audacious a thing to do. To my somewhat disappointment, I had a moderate success. But what happened over a period of time, the picture became well known and it kept playing. Every year I would get additional rental and royalty checks. It would play at midnight screenings on college campuses, things like that. So over a period of years, it did become a rather big success.
You did around 8 Edgar Allan Poe movies, all of which starred Vincent Price. Did you give him his start?
No.
In horror?
No. Vincent had done one horror film before he worked with me. I think it was the Murders in the Wax Museum or something like that in 3D that was successful. And, of course, before that, he'd been a well-known and established Hollywood and Broadway actor. But I think it was probably in the Poe pictures that he got his greatest acclaim, starting with The Fall of the House of Usher and then going to The Pit and the Pendulum all the way through, finally, to the last two films we did in England, Mask of the Red Death and The Tomb of Ligeia.
Your Poe movies seem, in a way, very deeply felt. And I guess I'm thinking particularly here of the Tomb of Ligeia. I mean, some of the movies you made, you were turning them out, let's face it, right? And some of them, you must have felt really deeply. I don't know what the question is, but I guess I'd like to hear about the difference for you between doing a movie that was deeply felt and one that was intended for another audience in a drive-in, and you didn't much care about the subject matter.
I'd always admired the work of Edgar Allan Poe very much, and I've read everything he's ever written. And I was very much desirous of doing The Fall of the House of Usher. And I was very pleased that the film had turned out well. And I did take the work very seriously. I had certain theories at that time, one of which is I thought that, or I believe that there are certain movements or times for change in human civilization. And I think that art and science go together more closely than people think. And I think in the 19th century, the concept of the unconscious mind was coming forward, and I felt just as Freud was moving there in a scientific manner, I think that Edgar Allan Poe was doing the same thing in an artistic way. So I tried to combine some of the theories of Freud with the works of Poe in order to bring them together on film as a synthesis.
Roger Corman recorded in 1990.